Brady. Many years on the bus ministry. It's taught you how to tell a story. Okay, we got to come back next week for 50B. It's prolonged. It's just going to be even longer. He learned from me how to take a lesson and turn it into more than a week. So this morning we're going to look at Exodus. We've been several weeks looking at the book of Exodus and the surrounding material to it. And last week we actually got into the text of it with the first five verses. And this morning we're going to look at Exodus chapter 1, verse 6 through 14. And the title of my lesson is Affliction and Multiplication. Affliction and Multiplication. Exodus chapter 1, verse 6 and down through 14. And Joseph died, and all his brethren, and all that generation. And the children of Israel were fruitful, and increased abundantly, and multiplied, and waxed exceeding mighty, and the land was filled with them. Now there arose up a new king over Egypt, which knew not Joseph. And he said unto his people, Behold, the people of the children of Israel are more and mightier than we. Come on, let us deal wisely with them, lest they multiply. And it come to pass that when there falleth out any war, they join also unto our enemies and fight against us, and so get them up out of the land. Therefore they did set over them taskmasters, to afflict them with their burdens. And they built for Pharaoh treasure cities, Pithom and Ramesses. And the more they afflicted them, the more they multiplied and grew. And they were grieved because of the children of Israel. And the Egyptians made the children of Israel to serve with rigor. And they made their lives bitter with hard bondage in mortar and in brick and in all manner of service in the field. All their service wherein they made them to serve was with rigor. So, as we look at this text, we pointed out last week that Exodus is very, we know it's part of the books of the law. Moses wrote Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, Deuteronomy. But I think even in my mind, I think, oh, Genesis is all that history, and then Exodus, we get into, the time of Moses. And Moses, as the author God chose to write these books, takes in the very first word of the book of Exodus and ties us back to what happened in Genesis. He wants us to see this tight connection between Genesis and Exodus. In Genesis, God makes his covenant with Abraham, and he repeats it and renews it over and over and over again. And then in Exodus, we have the covenant from the Mount Sinai. But there's this tight connection between Exodus and Genesis. And so we went through some of that, but then we see in verse 6 here, and Joseph died, and all his brethren, and all that generation. Now, so we just, I don't even have to turn a page, Genesis 50, verse 26, so Joseph died, being 110 years old, and they embalmed him, and he was put in a coffin in Egypt. So he was 110. This is when he died. The children of Israel were approximately, but probably pretty close to 71 years into their official, we might say, sojourn into Egypt. Jacob came down into Egypt when Joseph was 39 years old. We assume by just a pretty easy reading of scripture. Joseph was 30 when he got lifted out of prison and set up as a ruler in Egypt. They had 7 years of plenty, and then they were 2 years into the years of famine. So Joseph was 39. He dies at 110. So they're 71 years into the sojourn into Egypt. Of course, he had been probably about 93 years himself in the land of Egypt. But back in Exodus, it says, and Joseph died, and all his brethren, and all that generation. I don't know, I have a fascination with these types of things. You probably have been able to tell. In Exodus chapter 6, it tells us how old Levi was when he died. And he was 137 years old when he died. And in Genesis chapter 35, we can kind of see maybe the difference between Levi's age and Joseph's age. Levi was the third son of Leah, and Joseph was the first son of Rachel. We could read that passage without going into it. We could read that passage in two ways. One is that Joseph was born about 7 years after Jacob was married, or that he was born 13 years after. So we won't go into how you could read that those two ways, but I was looking at it again yesterday, and it could go either way, and different pastors that comment on these come up with those too. But either way, we have Levi being 5 to 10 years older than Joseph, and he died at the age of 137 years. So Levi, one of Joseph's brothers, died 88 or 83 years into the sojourn. So we have that. And I'm just pointing that out because the verse says Joseph died and all his brethren. And it says in all that generation. So that's all that generation would be, of course, his brothers. But that would be the wives and the servants of that age that came down with Jacob into Egypt. And it would also be the Egyptians who were that age that knew and loved Joseph. So it's not just Israel's. It's Joseph was very, wouldn't you agree? He was very influential in Egyptian life. You know, he changed the landscape of the land. Actually, many people believe he literally changed the landscape, dug a large canal that helped them control the flooding of the Nile and produce better crops. But that's just a side extra. But Joseph, there's actually a canal in Egypt that's still called the Joseph Canal. Not exactly that way, but it's kind of pretty much, you know, I don't know how people can deny that Joseph was there, but some people still do. There's a Joseph Canal. Anyway, everybody that knew Joseph, all that generation, his brothers, their wives, the servants of their age, and the rest of the Egyptians of that age died. So that's verse 6. Joseph died, all his brethren, and all that generation. And then verse 7 says, and the children of Israel were fruitful and increased abundantly and multiplied and waxed exceeding mighty, and the land was filled with them. So these words, we actually have already read some of this also. If you turn a couple pages back into Genesis 47, verse 27. This is right after Jacob moves into the land. All the children of Israel move down. And in verse 27, in Genesis 47, the Bible says, and Israel dwelt in the land of Egypt in the country of Goshen, and they had possessions therein, and grew and multiplied exceedingly, and Jacob lived in the land of Egypt 17 years. So, Jacob moves down into Egypt. We remember the story. Joseph asks, and Pharaoh grants, the king grants, that his family be given this land of Goshen. Goshen is northeast Egypt. Basically, the first thing, if you're coming out of Canaan into Egypt, you know, I don't know what the boundary line is, but you come in and you begin to see lots of grass and lots of fruitful land, you're there. It's the very first thing that you see as you come into Egypt if you're traveling on your camel or whatever back in the day. It's the boundary, it's the extent, the northeastern extent of Egypt. But it's very fruitful. This is where the delta of the Nile is. You remember your geography class? I remember way back in fourth grade learning about the delta of the Nile. The Nile's this huge river, runs uphill, or runs north, not really uphill, but runs north, and then as it gets close to the Mediterranean, it just spreads out into all these fingers, and there's this very fertile, fruitful delta. And this is the land of Goshen. So they're there, and they begin to multiply, and the inference is immediately. I mean, I'm not saying to the second, but, you know, they're there and they multiply. They grew, as Genesis 47 says. But it seems, it's interesting that the Bible tells us, and that God allowed, after Joseph died, they increase, we might say, fourfold or exponentially. They grow and they prosper. I'm not minimizing that. In fact, I'm saying this is a big thing. They're already growing and prospering. And then Joseph and his generation dies, and they begin to grow even more. So Joseph and his generation were a protection to the people of Israel in the foreign land of Egypt. They didn't have many adversaries. Maybe they didn't have any adversaries, but they were foreigners. And Joseph, with his influence and authority, was able to protect them. He reserved that land for them, all of this. But then Joseph dies, and God just multiplies their numbers, and so they become able to protect themselves, you might say, in a certain sense. The words there, fruitful, let's see here. The children of Israel, verse 7, were fruitful, increased abundantly. They were abundant, multiplied, and then waxed mighty. Those are four separate verbs. And the scriptures are trying to emphasize to us how great this growth and multiplication was. It was astonishing. It was astonishing to the people in Egypt. This land of Goshen it's the most fruitful land in Egypt. It's a very fruitful land. So in that sense, people that live there are healthier. They live longer. Everything is perfect for them to be healthy and grow and multiply. But God says it happened because of the circumstances. There was four verbs there to emphasize this almost miraculous growth and fruitfulness. As I mentioned, it seems that they increased even more once the protection of Joseph was gone. It was a very uncommon multiplication and fruitfulness. That's what these scriptures are these four verbs are trying to point out to us. Now we could think, well, how did it happen? I mean, it just wasn't like that, you know, they created, you know, they just appeared. Well, it seems most likely, I mean, how would it have happened? There was very healthy moms and very healthy babies. When we think back in history, ancient times, many mothers died in childbearing. Joseph's mother died in childbearing when she bore Benjamin. So mothers died in childbearing, and babies died young, in infancy. But so it would seem like at least that God protected and strengthened. They were a fruitful people, and so there was healthy mothers, healthy babies. Some people have, and it's not far-fetched at all to say there were lots of twins. Maybe even one, lots of twins I don't have a problem with. And not that I have a problem with this, but I was reading, one guy says, it seems obvious that there was lots of triplets and quadruplets. And I was like, okay, that's not very normal now. And maybe that's what I'm trying to say. This is not a normal multiplication. Maybe it was that, but I have never necessarily seen that. You can look at some of the list of the children of Israel, right? We have those lists in Chronicles, the chronologies, and all these other places. They're good for something. But primarily, how is interesting, but why is most important. This is the fulfillment of God's covenant promise with Abraham. Genesis. And here we have to just keep going back in here. Genesis 12, 15. I think we read that one last week. So let's read Genesis 13, 16, or I'll read it to you. Genesis 13, 16, God is speaking with Abraham, says, "And I will make thy seed as the dust of the earth." So that if a man can number the dust of the earth, then shall thy seed also be numbered. How many seed did Abraham have that God's referring to here? One. We can number that pretty easy. How many did that one have? Two. We're making progress, right? Okay, and then how many did that one have? He got four wives to help him, and he only had 12. Right? But God fulfills his promises. God keeps his covenants. And he does that here in Exodus in Egypt. One of the points here, now we don't know this by reading these verses, but not long after this, we count how many actually came out of Egypt, and it's 600,000 men and their families. And how many came in? So we go from 70, right? Or 75, if you count Joseph and his family's already there, from 75 to 600,000. Now that's a multiplication. That fits, right? That fits Genesis 15, verse 5. And he brought him forth abroad and said, look now toward the heaven and tell the stars if thou be able to number them. And he said unto him, so shall thy seed be. And Genesis 17, verse 2, and I'm just picked out three. There's about 7 or 8 or 10 of these times in Genesis. And I will make my covenant between me and thee and will multiply thee exceedingly. So God in Egypt is fulfilling he's keeping his promise, he's keeping his covenant. Matthew Henry said, and I kind of already got to this, but Matthew Henry said, from the call of Abraham, when God first told him he would make of him a great nation, to the deliverance of his seed out of Egypt, it was 430 years. During the first 215 years, they were increased to only 70. But in the second 215 years, those 70 multiplied to 600,000 fighting men. That's a miracle. That's God. I mean, he uses physical means, obviously, but that is amazing. And here we get it, we see it in these four verbs in verse 7. So then we come to verse 8, and we've looked at this verse not just kind of as a backdrop to our historical context, but we come to it now in the text. Now, verse 8, there arose up a new king over Egypt, which knew not Joseph. So this new king arose up. This gives the sense that it was a new dynasty. Remember how we were talking about like the 12th dynasty and the 18th dynasty and 19th dynasty, and some of these dynasties were concurrent. They were in this area and other ones here. But this new king seems to indicate that it's a new dynasty. It's not just the next in a succession. The next in a succession would have known about Joseph. But this is a new king, another succession. Even also that this arising seems to indicate that maybe he took power through conquest of the previous one or through a coup, maybe. And then we've already spent some time, let's think about the timing. Some people believe that there's only 20 plus or minus years after the death of Joseph that this took place. And it's possible. Most people believe that the time of the sojourn in Egypt is 215 years. And we know that Abram sojourned all the way from Ur and from Haran and all of that. But the time in Egypt, most believe it was 215 years. So if Levi dies 88 or 83 years into the sojourn, and we know Aaron, that would be Levi's great-grandson, is born with 83 years to go, because he was 83 when they left, that leaves between 44 and 49 years between the death of Joseph's generation and the birth of Aaron. Now, we assume that they're already in bondage by the time Aaron is born, because Moses is 3 years later, or in servitude. But so this just to think about a little bit of the timing there. It's very likely that the timing of the servitude and then the bondage is very soon after the death of Joseph and his generation. And in fact, we get that sense too. Joseph dies in this generation, and there arose up a new king. And this king puts them into servitude and bondage. He says, if there's any war, we already kind of mentioned the reasons for this. The children of Israel are in this northeast, they're in this boundary area where there would be, where if anybody was going to fight against Egypt, very likely they're going to come through that area, through that northeast, in your views, that northeast area of Egypt. So this was a common, the land area of Goshen was a common place of invasion. In fact, it was a place that people would want to have control over because it was so fruitful and lush. So in verse 11, I'm kind of jumping along there. He says, come on now, let us deal, this verse 10, wisely with them, lest they multiply. Well, they're already multiplying. And it come to pass that when there falleth out any war, and I mentioned that, they join also unto our enemies and fight against us, and so get them out of the land. Therefore, they did set over them taskmasters to afflict them with their burdens. So this verse, there seems to be a progression that happens here. It seems like the words used in this verse indicate that this leader somehow forced them into labor, but they were in labor detachments. They still had their own places to live, but they had a taskmaster over them that had work that needed to be done, and they would leave, they'd leave for a month to go work on something, and then they'd come back and another group would leave for a month. So it was kind of in a detachments type of way. Albert Barnes says this is probably forced labor detachments, but not like the slavery of war or war captives situation. Now, I believe that in another verse or two, we're going to see that this changes. But in the beginning, it seems like it was this type of a setup. And it says there that they, is that still in verse 11? Yes, in verse 11. And they built for Pharaoh treasure cities, Pithom and Ramses. Ramses provides for some people some difficulty, because, you know, they think that was named after Ramses II, the Pharaoh of the 1200s. And this is way after the time that the Bible indicates that the Exodus took place. And I have just a couple simple answers to that. First of all, Ramses is Ramses II. Okay, so there was one before him, if it was named after a man. Also, we know that Ramses was named after something. And Ramses itself was a region of Egypt long before Ramses was a king. So this city called Ramses was probably in the area of Ramses. How about that? Pretty simple. But if you want to find a problem in the Bible, you can find it. But we don't want to. I'm just trying to throw that out there as just some simple, you know, non-scholarly, just like, duh, answers to this problem that people have found. And they would not like my duh answer. They would see that it's very stupid and non-academic, and I'm too dumb to understand the problems that are in the Bible. But I'd rather just be simple faith and just believe. Anyway, we're running late. Gotta move along. There is, just to point out, and this is interesting, some linguistic similarities to pyramids in this clause. So, and they built for Pharaoh treasure cities. Some people say, well, that maybe could be translated the idea of a pyramid. And pyramids were a treasure hold for pharaohs. I don't know for sure. I'm not the linguistic expert, but some people see that. And one of the reasons they give credence to that is that at least at the time that the people were studying this that I was reading, there's no other historical reference to where these pyramids came from. They're mysterious. There's no record of them being written, you know, no written record of them being constructed or something like that. They just appear out of the sand. So not that it was never written about, but there's no record of it being written about. And perhaps this is some writing, which nobody likes to look at Exodus as history. It's the Bible, and so it must be questioned, rather than just it's a historical record. And we know it's more than that, but it is a historical record. So then verse 13, I think, is where their bondage changes. So because of what happens in verse 12, and we'll come back to that. But in verse 13, and the Egyptians made the children of Israel to serve with rigor. This indicates a change in the level or the fierceness of the bondage. Israel in Leviticus 25 was prohibited from making their slaves or their servants serve with rigor. At Leviticus 25, 43 and 46, they were not allowed to enslave and make their servants work with this kind of rigor, hardness, fierceness. And they made their lives bitter with hard bondage in mortar and in brick and in all manner of service in the field. All their service wherein they made them serve was with rigor. Mortar, brick, mud brick was a common and an easy building material. Then they'd build the bricks. They'd make the bricks and then they'd put them together into walls with mortar. And all manner seems to indicate perhaps irrigation and canals that they wanted built to further the advancements of, you know, the Nile is very powerful, but it has to be directed. But verse 12, and I need to stop, but I can't skip it because it's the whole point of this lesson. Verse 12 says, but the more they afflicted them, the more they multiplied and grew. Praise the Lord. The more they afflicted them, the more they multiplied and grew. And they were grieved because you want to grieve the world? You want to grieve the Egyptians? Multiply and grow in the midst of affliction. And they were grieved because of the children of Israel. So, periods of increase and growth, right after they came there, after the death of Joseph, and after the beginning of the afflictions. And this points out that the growth was in relation to the afflictions. The more they afflicted them, the more they grew. Oh, so let's afflict them some more. What's going to happen? They're going to grow some more. Poor Egyptians. They are not in control, are they? God is in control. And affliction is affliction. I don't want to lighten it. But the Bible has in Psalm 119 some positive views of affliction. Let's think about this for ourselves. Before I was afflicted, I went astray, but now I've kept thy word. It is good for me that I've been afflicted, that I might learn thy statutes. I know, O Lord, that thy judgments are right and that thou in faithfulness hast afflicted me. I'm afflicted very much. Quicken me, O Lord, according to thy word. So God heard their affliction. He's going to redeem them and rescue them and take them out of this affliction. But God uses affliction. He uses it for his own glory. Here, he turned it against the Egyptians by allowing the Israelites to increase. And as we finish last week's lesson, we're going to say again, just like last week, God is working out his plan. He made a promise to Abraham, and he's working it out. He's working it out in the people of Israel. And when we face trouble, he's working it out in our lives. If we face affliction, he's going to use that for his own glory. Either he's going to get our attention and teach us or strengthen us, whatever it is. I don't know if you're in affliction, but when we're in affliction, we should look to see what God is doing in our lives because he's always working.